Theological Seminary's Chapel Podcast.
Thank you. Let me introduce our speakers this week and our panel. Actually, I want to say panel. I'm going to ask a question or two, and then we're going to open it up to you and let you ask questions, and you can see our mics on either side. And that's what we're really after. We want to know what your questions are. And we'll probably stay around just a few minutes afterwards if you want to speak to any of our chapel speakers for this week. James Womack is on my right, and James spoke on Tuesday. And Rod McElvain is next to him. And I've asked Mike Pocock to sub in for John Bryson. John had to go back to Memphis. It was called back some kind of family issue. So we pulled in Mike Pocock. Michael, thank you so much for being here. Let me begin with a question. Suppose someone has been sitting out here this week and they say, I think I'm interested in church planting. I'm sensing a call, whatever that term means. How would you advise me in terms of where I would go from here? What would be my next move? What would be the next series of moves?
Go ahead.
Rod, why don't you jump in?
I don't know. Thank you. The mic's picked that up. Well, there are a number of church planting organizations that are out there right now, and those church planting organizations these days are doing a really good job of providing testing materials to people who think they might want to plant a church. And some of those organizations are Kaleo. They're out in California. What Bob Rowley is with the Evangelical Free Church. There are some really good organizations out there. And I think it's really helpful to plant with an organization if you can, because the organization can provide a lot of resources, a lot of materials, a lot of expertise from people who have done it before. These days, you know, there is not just one kind of church to plant. There are many different kinds of churches out there. And so you may feel like you've got a desire to plant one kind of a church, but you get around somebody who's got an expertise in different sorts of churches, and you can get ideas about how to plant a niche church that's really relevant to your needs. But one of the best things that these guys do is they do testing. And the testing really helps to refine that call. Because if I have a passion for church planting, and I take a test, and that test suggests that I'm not the pioneer that I thought I was, maybe I could be part of a team with a guy who is a pioneer. And that can really empower me to make the best use of my gifts. I mean, a lot of guys who got a passion for church planting, they're not pioneers, they're not entrepreneurs, but they still make outstanding church planters when they're part of a team.
Yeah, excellent. What we're going to do is I'm going to continue to ask questions. And as I see you, if you move to the mic, then I know that you'll have a question. So I'll continue to ask until that takes place. In terms of going it alone, parachuting into a situation, a particular culture, some fellows have done it that way. Others have come alongside a church and found a church that will sponsor them and work with them. Sometimes they'll bring them on staff maybe for a year or two and cultivate them and develop them and encourage them and train them and then back them as they go out into the community. Which one of those two would you favor, and what are the advantages of either?
I think that both options are there and available for church planting. I concur with what my brother said as far as being assessed and going to an organization to be assessed around people who are doing church planting. I would also add to what he said is to really study the different models of church planting, which leads into this question. If you go in and you just parachute into a community and you go as an individual, or you go as a team. Now, I really would recommend going as a team, because church planting is difficult. Ministry is difficult. And doing ministry as a long ranger is an old paradigm. And so a biblical paradigm, Ecclesiastes 4, two are better than one. They have a greater return for their labor. And you all know the rest of that passage. But I think it's important to plant as a team. And then go and be part of a team to where you fit and you bring a unique gift set as part of that team. Whether you're a behind the scenes person, you're a technology person, you're a discipleship person, you're an evangelistic person, but going to become part of a team and having a unique part and place on that team. I would also recommend, if you're fresh out of seminary or hadn't had a lot of ministry experience, I would recommend partnering on staff with another church if possible for a year or a year and a half. That would be an intentional year of learning about doing ministry. So you can have great Bible knowledge, But you need biblical wisdom to start a church and do ministry. So I would encourage someone to go and be mentored, be discipled, be encouraged. There are some groups out there like Fellowship Associates in Little Rock, Arkansas, who bring guys in for a year, pay them a small salary, but offering them a lifetime of training and investment in doing leadership, putting together your plan, doing your demographics and things like that.
And I would add to that, I planted a church. The first church I planted was, it was very frustrating, very difficult. I had been in a parachurch ministry for 10 years. And I thought, I've been in parachurch ministry, I can plant a church, no problem. And I got into that situation, and there was a lot that I did not know. And so I pulled back, regrouped, got mentored by Bill Counts at Fellowship Bible Church at Park Cities at the time. And that's what I needed to go back out and plant a church in a way that was much more informed. So I think your comments about that are really good.
Yeah, mentioning Bill Counts, in our church planning class, I just met Dr. Rodney Orr, actually had on his list of people who really mentored him at the beginning of his ministry while he was still here in Dallas studying at the end of the 80s and early 90s. Was Bill Counts. And you do find, I think, while you're in seminary, that if you can get to know local pastors who have a vision for their community or for multiplying churches, to know them well while you're a student really, really helps. I think in my case, I was going to Venezuela to start churches later on to teach in a seminary. And while in seminary, I pastored a little church that was manageable. It was like a startup. Some people wouldn't even have called it a church. It was two storefronts on the south side of Chicago and had about 35 people that were meeting. But what that did was give me a manageable opportunity. I think they could pay me enough to pay my rent. That was all it was. But what I learned was I learned Latin American people there in particular, and I was going to Venezuela in any case, and my wife and I. So it was manageable, and yet all the issues of family life, of worship, of teaching and preaching all came up in that, so that when I got to Venezuela and started a little bit more on my own, that background with all of its challenges and successes really helped. I was told by one of my professors, because I actually got to think at the end of seminary, maybe I shouldn't go anywhere else. Maybe I shouldn't go to Venezuela. Stick with this church, these couple of storefronts here. But a professor said to me, Mike, I'll tell you the history of storefront churches. I don't care how good a preacher you are, 20 years from now, that's going to be two storefronts. So whatever you thought God wanted you to do before you got here, go on ahead and do it. So I did. But those people in that church, we had really bonded during those 3 years. And they sustained us and helped us all the time that we were in Venezuela. And finally, another fellow came along named Mark Job. And Mark Job then took those little two storefronts, and they have about 5,500 people in 13 satellite churches in Chicago today. And he's the kind of person who knows how to develop other workers. So everybody who is pastoring one of the churches that they as a sort of center church have started, every one of those was developed in the context of a relationship with that with Mark Job. So I think, getting somehow or another, getting together with a leader who has a passion to multiply and can develop you and show you how to do it, that's really key. Don't necessarily try to be a lone wolf. I think that I had not even thought about whether I wanted to work alone or not. I just didn't know enough about the whole project to do that. Never took a course in church planting or anything. I got two single women to work with my wife and I in Valencia, Venezuela. And all of my stereotypes about why I wouldn't want to work with a single woman were all swept away. These were grand women, and together we got something going that really was a blessing. So I firmly believe in church planting teams. Not too big, but with cohesion and power.
I want to also mention that this next semester, we have two church planting courses here, one with more of the missional international emphasis, and then we have in the PM department one that I teach with a little bit more of a local emphasis. And we're offering ours in the spring. And missions, are you offering church planting in the spring?
Right now in the fall.
Okay, and it's going on right now. feel free to come sit in, I would think. Also, a number of pastors around town are very interested and are taking time out, lunch breaks, to work together with students to talk more about that. If you're interested in that, touch bases with me and I can tell you who they are. Yes.
Okay. Sometimes church planning can be seen as competitive with churches that are already established in certain areas. What steps are you taking to ensure that you're working with and not against fellow churches?
I'll just start off with it. Number one, I might go sit down with them and visit with them, take them for lunch, take them for coffee, and tell them that you feel God is leading you into that area, and that you're not there to compete or to take their people away. Some have even gone so far as if people have left the church to come to their planted church, of saying, now, look, we want you to go back and talk with that pastor and make sure that he understands that we're not taking you away, that this is your choice. And so some have chosen to go about it that way.
When we planted Grace Community Church in 1995, it was a fairly churched area, and yet... The people that were with me in planting the church told me that there were no churches that had a thriving small group ministry and no churches that were doing active discipleship. Now, whether that was true or not, that was the research that they had done as I was becoming involved with them. And so we had a particular niche in the community that was really unique. And when we started with 5 to 7 small groups, and everybody in our church was in a small group, that caused a lot of buzz around our community, and people saw what we were doing as a niche that was different than what they were doing. When we switched into the missional direction, it was clear that the churches were not doing missional ministry in our area. And so our idea was to equip those churches to do missional ministry. If we had an area of expertise, we wanted to help them in that area, so that it was clear that not only were we not competing, but we were trying to equip other churches in the area to do things that we had found to be very successful. And that gave us a tremendous amount of goodwill and continues to give us a tremendous amount of goodwill within the city. We've started a Celebrate Recovery in another church. We're starting our second Celebrate Recovery in another church. We started an Apples of Gold ministry for women in a church. We're doing that in another church as well. And the idea is that if we're doing something that's successful and that works, and other churches hear about it, we want to help equip them, even if that means we don't get additional members. And so, as I mentioned on Wednesday, our building's paid off. God has really blessed us in many ways. So we kind of feel like we want to be missionally driven within the community and help people who need help. Not thinking about our numbers, but thinking about how we can have spiritual influence.
I would add to that it's not just competitive in the church plants, it's competitive among established churches as well. And depending upon the people you're dealing with, that element's gonna be present. But the issue is, what are your values? What's your character? And how do you deal with that? So you're going to have people who come to your church and say, well, I'm from such and such church. And then how do you deal with that? How do you interact with that person? How do you interact with someone who comes from a friend of yours church and now they're going to be part of your church? What are your next steps on that? So I think being intentional about your communication, being intentional about connecting with the other pastors in the community. But the element of competitiveness among churches is not a church planting issue. It's just a human nature issue. And so as long as Romans 7 is true, and we have this thing called the flesh, you're going to have competition out there, and people who perceive it as such. But then you be careful to make sure that you're not promoting that and propagating that.
You know, we say in fishing that you can't beat local information. You know, the best thing you can do when you pull up to a river is to go talk to people that are already there and see what they've been doing and what's been working for them. On the other hand, those same people would probably not appreciate it if you walked right up alongside of them because you saw them catch a fish and start casting. You know, that'd be crowding them out. There's a decent space to be apart from them. And I think this goes is very true about church establishment, and it answers the question of this matter of is there competition. if you do, as our brother mentioned, go into a community and talk to who's already there. You know, which churches are there? Go talk to them. Ask them what they think is the most unreached area. Ask who they don't seem to be reaching. And you're going to find that those conversations establish a bond between you and them. They're always going to say in the future, you know, that guy was a pretty decent guy. He came and talked to me before he started. He didn't just start up down the block without, you know, sort of giving the impression that what they were doing just didn't count, that what you are doing is the true thing and the real thing. That really bothers people. And you don't want enemies in that community. You need friends and allies. So talking to people helps. My wife and I worked with Team for some 16 years, and I was on a team to go to Italy to establish whether or not Northern Italy needed a mission like ours. And we talked to Pentecostals, Brethren, and Baptists, and also established missionaries from interdenominational groups. And we spent several weeks just talking to every one of them and finding out, what do you think is the most unreached and needy area of Italy? Well, they were able to point the area out, which is where Team is today. But most importantly, all of those groups are like our allies. They all feel good about us. And that really helps, because those same churches from other parts of Italy will send somebody to you that moved to your city and say, you know, I need a church that I can relate my people to. I got somebody who just came to know Christ and they need help. You know, like Mark Jobs from Chicago called me up on his way into the office the other day and said, Mike, I've got a couple here that work with Univision. And they came to know Christ up here in Chicago. They developed beautifully. But I want to be sure that they are plugged into a good Bible preaching church down there. So could you just give them a call and talk to them and see what's happening? And I got in touch with them, and lo and behold, they're part of Fellowship Bible Church up in here in North Dallas. They've already found it. It's not far from their home. Well, that's easy to do in the Bible Belt, to find a good place. Not so hard, not so easy in other places. But relating to other leaders really will help.
Lynn?
I've been part of a church plant for a little over a year. I didn't plant the church. Brian Bellflower, who's a graduate of Dallas Seminary, planted it, graduated in 2002, and the church was formally launched a little over a year ago up in the McKinney, Frisco area. And to your point about the personality types, he certainly fits that. And I'm not saying anything that he and I haven't talked about or that he wouldn't say himself. He's an entrepreneur. He's amazing in terms of his creativity, in terms of breaking new ground, all of those kinds of things. But as he has said, and I would say it's been a tough year, and even the preview services were fairly tough as well. His goal was to target de-churched and unchurched people, and it's very missional in terms of his design and his intent. The thing that's surprising, even if with that intent, is the mindset of people who come. So there is some success in connecting with those people, but it's almost like it's a post-church culture. And I'm wondering, as a question, how pervasive you think that is. So as an example of a post-church culture, de-churched, unchurched, you have somebody come, and then they don't come for another 2 weeks or another 3 weeks, and you call them. Let's say they came 5 weeks later, 6 weeks later, and very irregular. So you call them because in your mindset, that is inconsistent attendance. It's not being pejorative here, I'm just being descriptive. From their perspective, the fact that they came once every 5 weeks or every 6 weeks is evidence of huge commitment on their part. So, you know, one of the things that we wrestle with, me more vicariously, Brian directly, is just the whole framework, the mindset. And I'm wondering how that's challenging churches today, and maybe I can take back some encouragement to Brian.
That's a great question, Dr. McLaughlin. I'm gonna read a text to you. Good morning, how is your soul? How are you doing spiritually? Praying the best for you, but need your help. Call me. And so that was a note to a person who is a member of our church, part of our church, but has only been there once in 6 weeks. Here's the response. Soul equal great, exclamation point. Spiritually equal great. And then they go into some physical ailments that they've been having. So their conclusion is that their soul is doing great and they're doing great spiritually, but have only been to church, their church family, once in 6 weeks. And I think that's part and parcel to where we are in our culture today. I was meeting with someone on yesterday, and one of their team members called and asked if they could shift their volunteer schedule because it interferes with their tea time on Sundays twice a month. Smile at me. And I think that's the reality of the milieu that we're dealing with. And I think when you're reaching people who have not grown up in traditional church and people who are just coming to Christ today, their church attendance patterns are much different from a historical Christian's church patterns. So what I'm learning is that people consider normal church attendance now 2 or 3 times a month. Mm-hmm. And that's considered normal. And that they don't see any problem with not showing up or calling somebody if they're not showing up or staying connected. So I think that's the new reality. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to adjust to it and adjust our assimilation systems and adjust our connection systems, because I think that's the par for the course now.
And I might add, I think it's also good to adjust maybe our discipleship expectations, because one of the things I've found is that when I would teach on the value of corporate worship, that I would have people who would be very surprised at that. And you know, I would, and I've done this on a number of occasions, taught about corporate worship as a discipleship value. Why do you do corporate worship? And I would go back to the fact that, you know, early on it was the Sabbath, which was Friday night to Saturday night. Why do they meet on Sunday? Was it a cost to meet on Sunday? Well, that was a work day. That was our Monday, if I'm getting it right. And why would they do that? And why would the writer of Hebrews say, don't forsake the assembling together as is the habit of some? And when I would disciple people on the value of corporate worship, they would think, oh, you know, I never thought about it that way. Whereas under the Christendom model, was, I got to do this or there's something wrong with me. And so I'm guilty and I feel bad about this. And so Christian liberty is, I don't go to church. Whereas in the post-Christendom model, people are thinking, oh, really? Okay, now, so I see that it matters that I gather with other people for corporate worship because it's good for me. It helps me to see the greatness and the majesty of God that I might not see if I was just doing this Christian life alone.
Yes.
My question is, you know, as you approach the 10 or 15 year mark on a church plant, can you kind of talk about the transition from maybe the church planter mindset to now I've got these people who are coming and I need to shepherd the flock? Do you ever get bored with, you know, just shepherding the flock? Do you miss that, you know, the driver, the excitement of actually getting to create, you know, something new? How do you, I don't know if that makes sense, how do you maintain that? Or do you always see yourself as a church planter, even, you know, 15 or 20 years into a church plant? So,
well, I can tell you, I love being an entrepreneur, but I like being an entrepreneur as part of a team. And so our church has constantly had entrepreneurial ventures that have been very exciting. Raising 90,000 pounds worth of medical supplies to send to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, planting churches in Cuba, things like that. So a lot of my church planter passion really got channeled in both the missional direction and in the international missions direction. And so that for me was really exciting. So the fact that I had the privilege of planting the church that I'm at for 17 years has given me a lot of leadership leverage to be able to, you know, pioneer some entrepreneurial things. And I have loved that. That has been the thing that has really charged me up about long-term ministry in the same place. And every once in a while, something new will come up. And you know, we'll do this new project that will last us 3 years. And it really gets me excited. I would be bored if it was maintaining.
And I would add that shift comes before 10 or 15 years, because if you're in a dynamic, visionary, Great Commission church, you always challenge yourself to reach people for Christ and keeping your congregation motivated to reach people for Christ, finding new and innovative ways to continue sharing the gospel and being a missional community. That's the challenge. And then it suggests, I think it was Peter Drucker, that each time your church doubles, you need to change your structure. So if your church is consistently reaching people and making new disciples, then you're growing. And then as you're growing, you've got to restructure and retool how you do things. If you're equipping leaders, you've got better equipped leaders, so now you can do more because your capacity is greater. And so I think your church is always changing and evolving. And so what I've been planning now for 6 years and been involved with church plants just for years, but I think that we've had to make that shift a couple of times already as a church. And so it doesn't get boring if you're doing, if you're making disciples in the ministry, it doesn't get boring.
I like to challenge church planters. I tell them, don't plant a church. They say, well, what are you talking about? I say, plant churches. We want to plant churches that in turn plant churches. If I were to go back into pastoral ministry again and I were to come here to Dallas, I would come as a church planter, and my strategy would be to plant churches as much as possible all over Dallas, because that's a movement, and that's what we need right now is a movement. So I don't challenge them to plant a church, but to plant churches, to become a church planting church, among other things. Yes.
Dr. Pocock, you mentioned working with a couple single women. If I'm a woman who has a passion for church planting, what is the role of women in this whole thing? And we know that women make up the majority of churches, and how do women play a specific role in this kind of project?
Well, thank you very much for that. And in our case, the two women who helped us, one was had been a specialist in Christian education, and I'm not for organizing perhaps anything. I'm a very spontaneous person, but what she knew was she knew sound educational principles and organization. So, our church grew rapidly, and we needed that organization, and we needed the CE part. And so, Marcia gave us that. Actually, we had two Marcias, and the other one was really good with university student evangelism and cell group growth. So we benefited a great deal from a lot of outreach to the local university, and then they, this being Latin America thinks a little bit differently than Americans, where we are so much more individualistic, but a university student in Latin America still loves his mom and dad and his brother and his sister, and is probably going to get them involved if they are local at all. And so we discovered that university students who were being led to Christ by Marcia Stevens, that they were being developed by her and coming into the church, and then also they would bring with them older and younger and brothers and sisters. It worked very well together. So small group development and discipleship of women, which I think was appropriate for Marcia, and my wife was able to join her in that as well. And then the other Marcia working on Christian education, that really put our package together very nicely. You can be dissed sometimes as a woman, and I can remember one of our partners in that ministry, being very disappointed at one point where we had to do some negotiations with a local group, and I suggested that Marcia could do that while I was out of town, and a brother got up and said, Don Miguel, that's not women's work. That's a man's work. Wait till you come back and do it. And I could just sort of see her shrink, that she was not regarded by Venezuelans as an authoritative person to do a business deal with other people. So there are some great sides to being a woman in ministry, but sometimes you can meet up with some very distinct ideas in male-dominated cultures.
I would just say one more thing about the women in ministry. We started a church planter training school in Magarabumba, Cuba, and that training school graduates 17 church planters a year. And our philosophy is to let the national leaders make the decisions. And roughly one-third of our graduates are female church planter senior pastors. And I've often asked, you know, the folks in Latin America about that. You know, how do you deal with some of the passages? And they've wrestled with 1 Timothy and so on. And basically what they said was, look, if we didn't have female church planters, we would not have churches. And so we look at that reality as being our guiding light. And we do encourage men to step up, but we would not have new churches if we didn't have a significant number of female church planters. And, you know, I don't know how that translates into the U.S., but it sure is that way in Cuba.
Yeah, I think that's cultural. You can go to the mic. I think that's cultural when it comes to the role of women in ministry. And I would encourage you guys, both male and female, to really think through and document, research, and write your position on women in ministry, and then specifically how that looks. So I think we find a hard position of, well, they can't do ministry, can't do ministry. I don't think it's an issue of if they can or cannot do ministry. I think it's an issue of where and how can they do ministry. And so I think it's important to really think through that as a male and a female. I think since you made the comment that in the church that you're around, a lot of them are females who are populating the ministry, there are huge opportunities for women in ministry. And so I really think through, how can I minister to women, and how has God uniquely equipped me to minister to women in your instance? And then think through, what are some solutions that you have for ladies? Is it working moms who need help in the evenings? Is it stay-at-home moms? Is it moms who are trying to do ministry? Are they widows? So what group are you trying to minister to? And how can you organize ministry for them? And of the pastors I know, they would love to have somebody come by and say, I'm available, whether they're male or female. And they would love to get you involved in ministry. If you can't find one in Dallas, come to Fort Worth. And
I'm just wondering whether there are organizations, like one of the speakers said, that help plant churches, whether there are such that believe in women ministry. Some of us, I believe, I've seen myself, God using me to start a lot of things in different areas, even before I came here and since I've been here. But I know I'm a teacher by profession, but I still believe I need to start things. Naturally, it happens. I don't know how. But do we have people that can help women, more so international people, to do what they believe God wants them to do?
Yeah, I think what's already been pointed out that women are ready, capable, and desirous of being used in significant ways in the Lord's work. And if you're from North America, or you're from, say, the Bible Church movement or the general evangelical movement, you probably are not thinking about women as primary leaders in the church, or like being a lead pastor. In fact, the seminary says we are not planning to prepare women as lead pastors, and yet we have 25% women at the school. And so obviously that's an indication that we do believe that women are incredibly significant and in fact do discharge major ministries. Once again, and Rodney Orr actually gave us a list in class just before we came here of everybody that made a difference in his life at the very earliest stages of becoming a believer. And I noticed that Henrietta Mears was in there. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. See, Henrietta Mears actually was a premier Christian education specialist. He founded Gospel Light Publications, I believe, in California. And she had a Bible class of 400 university students, in which Bill Bright got saved of Campus Crusade. Richard C. Halverson was saved and developed in the context of that class. Bob Boyd Munger, who wrote My Heart, Christ's Home. You could just go on down the line and mention major leaders over the last 20 years that came to know Christ or were developed in Henrietta Mears' classes. But I think that your question was, how can we help women start ministries, kind of grab the reins and do something in ministry? That's a great question. I'm not dead sure that I know the answer to how women can help other women to get started, or how men can get help women to get started in ministries. But a lot of things for us men, I think we need to remember is you don't have to do everything. You have to, but you may need to give the green light to people. And I think sometimes women do not know that they have a green light to do something unless you encourage them and give them that green light. So that's one thing. If you have a desire as a woman to inspire other women to attempt great things for God, just challenge them. Just tell them, have you ever thought of yourself doing this or that? And it's amazing what could happen. In my own personal case, I've made mistakes in this regard. I do love seeing women at work in ministry. They are very effective. But I'll still make big mistakes, like going to a pastoral luncheon in Japan, and I saw a lot of women there. And so, among other things, I said, I want to tell you men, all you pastors, how much I appreciate the fact that you brought your wives here today. And so then somebody had to whisper over to me, my translator, they are not wives, Dr. Pocock, they are ministers, they are pastors. Okay, just hadn't thought about that before. But then going over to China, if you go to China, you'll find the same thing. I mean, about 50%, maybe even more than 50% of the pastors are women. And some of them have incredibly large churches. One of them, I asked her, you know, how big her church was. She said about 4,000 or so on the weekends. I said, oh, okay. How did that church get started? My mother started it. I said, wow, she must have been quite some woman. Well, she was a very humble woman. And I said, well, you must be quite a good preacher, too, that you can hold 4,000 people together on a weekend. No, she says, not really. She said, actually, everybody ministers to each other. And I'm just the person who raised the flag up the pole and said, let's do this. And everybody jumped on board. So, you know, my experience has been to discover that women have much greater roles in general outside North America than they do inside North America relative to ministry. So I think we can encourage each other along those lines.
Yeah, I would add to that, I think there's even a lot of opportunity within America that may be beyond a DTS construct for doing ministry. I know this is a very sensitive issue when it comes to women in ministry, but I think it's highly cultural. So when you go into many, many mainstream denominations now, the role of women in ministry is not an issue. And so you can pretty much do whatever you want to do. And so without proposing or endorsing what people do outside of a DTS construct, there are many opportunities to do ministry. I would encourage you from a practical standpoint to, number one, define what God's given you as it relates to ministry and calling and gifting. Two, I would encourage you to take classes with the CE department and really taking seriously on putting together your ministry program, your ministry platform or prospectus. I would encourage you to take the church planting class with Dr. Malfers, who's going to look at all the ins and outs of doing church planting. Most of the time when you have a visionary is good with the big picture and the end result, but doesn't have a clue on how to paint the picture in the middle. And so they would love to have somebody come along who may not be at the forefront, may not be the figurehead for the organization, but has somebody who can come and add infrastructure to help detail policy, procedure, how we're going to set up our structures internally within our ministry structure. And very often, the Bible doesn't restrict that from females. So I would encourage you to really know what you're capable of doing, define that, and then just go do it.
Paul, we have run out of time. Okay. If you will come up afterwards, we'll take you first. We will hang out here for a while. So please feel free to come up here afterwards. I want to thank our panelists. They came at their own expense. We have no budget for doing this. So. You're dismissed. Thank you for being with us.